Good. So it looks like East and West are meeting in a big way. And while there is, while this is happening, we may kind of boldly sketch some very significant differences in which East and West have basically conceived of mind and conceived of the task, how to understand mind. Without wanting to say that, you know, Buddhism and psychology have similar goals, they do not, but we can appreciate offerings both traditions have to make, even though one of them seems to be 2,500 years old and the other one only a mere skimpy 150 years old. We have in the West a history of ideas and a history of mind that goes way back, long before the establishment of psychology as an academic discipline in the late 1870s of the 19th century. So if we want to sketch some of the tasks each of these traditions have basically identified, then we could say that the Eastern tradition, and I'm speaking as a Buddhist now, so take when I say East, take this to mean some form of Buddhist teaching, because I'm not really an expert on other Eastern teaching. We can say that the East is focused on the vertical line, the dimension of the timeless, very clearly, conditionality, complete liberation, suchness, the universal dimension, very clearly established, a powerful emphasis on looking, associating, seeking congruency with the timeless dimension in our lives. And the West has, with the same emphasis, right from the Greeks onward, insisted on the horizontal. It has insisted on a life in time. It has insisted as this time unfolds in the life of an individual human being during a lifetime. So the East clearly asserts timeless dimensions which seem to often do little justice to the personal dimension in our experience. The West, with equal emphasis, has insisted on a consideration of the lifetime of an individual. It has the horizontal, the expanse of time as it unfolds in an individual lifetime. There is a great emphasis. There is no doubt that on the shrines of the West is the individual subject. Our individualism is, I think, beyond question. The preoccupation with individuation, becoming such an individual, the big tasks of such an individual, self-understanding, self-determination, self-actualization, these are the big issues in the West, both philosophically and psychologically. This has been identified as the big task, and much of Western thinking focuses around this. So, wrestling power from the gods, wrestling power from the kings, bringing the individual into a place of self-responsibility. Self-responsibility is a very Buddhist concept, by the way. Stopping to blame the government, the king, God, for my condition, and basically stop moping. Stop moping and taking responsibility for my experience. Smartening up. Learning to acknowledge what I bring along. Connect with others and move on. These are big Western tasks. And Buddhist traditions have come to something very similar, although under different headings. And if you want to boil down very tersely, the major task of Buddhist tradition is what we in the West would consider to focus on the content of individual experience, to shift from that obsession with content of individual experience. The West is interested in the what the individual experiences. And Buddhist traditions keep insisting that we need to shift our awareness, our focus of awareness, away from the specific what to the how we experience. So it's not the content, not the what of an individual's experience that matters so much as it is the how this experience comes about. It is the awareness of the experiencer rather than the awareness of the experiencer's content of experience. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
If you want to boil it down to something very, very simple, then this is the big message of, say, Buddhist teaching. Learning to disentangle our preoccupation, the focus of our habituated awareness with content of experience, to the awareness of the experience of itself. That's what the Eastern tradition calls returning the light. So rather than me being fixated and having my attention going out to individual events and things and objects, what the Chinese so beautifully call the world of 10,000 things, I learn to train faculties of mind that bring into focus not the what, but the how, the experience of itself. This apparently solid protagonist of my story, which seems to be receiving this world with its senses and with its mind. That becomes the sole task, to get a perspective on this rather than on that. Does that make sense? Because that's pretty crucial. Now, the truth is we need both. That's my current understanding. There is no way we can get a process, we can get a perspective on our own story unless we are willing to leave the bits we keep preoccupying ourselves with and get a perspective on how we hold ourselves. I do not see any chance that we can find clarification by fiddling with bits of experience, by fiddling with objects, by fiddling with states, by fiddling with conditions. Because that leaves out of the picture the apparently receiving subject that wants these states, objects, events, conditions to be fixed, preferably so that they're pleasant, preferably so that the unpleasant stuff doesn't happen. And if I have my say, not just a little bit, but forever. Happiness, perfect, complete, ecstatic happiness forever. If I'm honest, this is what I'm about. If I'm really honest, I don't want a little bit of contentment. I want perfect happiness forever and safety that this stays that way. Deep down, this is what it really wants. Now, obviously, this is not really likely to occur, isn't it? We all know this is not likely to occur. So what we do, we seem to cheat. We pretend to know all this, and then we try to settle for forms of happiness that we can get hold of. Yeah. Strawberries, life insurance, an appropriate car, sane relationships, vanilla fudge. And these things all deliver. There's a great power in relationship. Both Buddhist teaching and practice and Western psychology insists that much of our learning happens in the context of relationship. They insist that material prosperity is useful. They insist that harmony in our societies is a crucial factor for contentment. They have different words for this, but they both are quite in agreement about this. Can we maybe close the windows again? Because I have a feeling the initial fresh air was a great idea. But yeah? Maybe we have to do boost air. So when we sit down to meditate, We do not begin at zero. The challenge is that we come to this task with a sort of half-fermented knowledge of ourselves and a slightly biased understanding of what there is to do. And it is part of practice to gradually find out how we get this wrong. Most of practice is about getting it wrong. If you haven't found out that, please consider this possibility. Consider this possibility that your practice consists largely in how to tolerate getting things wrong and moving on. Doing this little number I just outlined. Stop moping, smarten up, acknowledge what we already bring along, get connected, move on. This is my little mantra. It's a bit reductionist, admittedly, but I believe it's quite accurate. Moping means we do a lot of blaming. We do disown our own responsibility in what happens to us. Obviously, we do not have power to decide what happens to us. We all know this. Earthquakes happen. Governments are disappointing. Much of what determines our happiness is beyond our control. This is not a secret. There is no mystery about this. We all know this in some deep down way. But we live as if we didn't know, isn't it? There is a remarkable discrepancy between what we know and how we behave. And this discrepancy is not easy. It's unflattering to acknowledge this discrepancy. It puts us on edge. We don't cope well with uncertainty. We don't cope well with having needs that are not clear, where it's not clear whether they will be met. Psychologically, we put up a good fight that this doesn't come to consciousness. And so we live in degrees of unreality. We have not just learned to adapt, we have also learned to maladapt to situations. And much of meditation practice is coming to acknowledge actually what is not true that we operate by, what is maladaptation, what we need to unlearn. We already do a lot of things. Meditation is not magic. It happens with perception, it happens with attention, it happens with body, it happens with self-awareness. It happens with inherent qualities of mind to understand and to become still. All this stuff is already in place. It's not the Buddhists who have invented that. It's not. You don't have to cook this up. Your mind is already doing this. It is doing this in particular ways. And the configuration of these particular ways is something we gradually begin to find out when we meditate. This is not how we may frame our project of meditation. It's certainly not how I framed the project of meditation for myself. My project, I think I've outlined, was getting more smart and getting more in control. And I was expecting this to last not very long, and then I would be kind of fixed. I would have my software glitch ironed out, and I would continue living my life happily and move on. That was my plan. And maybe you're less naive than I was, but I would expect you to hold notions, both of yourself, what meditation and spiritual practice and liberation is, that turn out to be not true. And much of our practice of meditation and of the path to awakening will begin to hinge in how we cope with the parts that do not conform to our expectations. In other words, it's not about my intrinsic awakening. That's there, I have no doubt. But it's about how I cope with my neurosis, how I cope with my resistance, how I cope with the parts of me that do not want to wake up, that just want to drink beer and be left in peace, or that want to get in my way, or that don't want to get out of the comfort zone, or so much of my meditation practice and my spiritual path will suddenly have to deal with the stuff that is not about enlightenment and awakening. That is about resistance, neurosis, contraction, laziness, forms of not knowing, anything from downright ignorance to bloody-minded, not wanting to know. Yeah? As soon as I begin to meditate, I will have to deal with these things in some way. Now that is where I think psychology and psychotherapeutic understandings have a lot to offer, because the actual terrain of my meditative practice happens to be in the same way, in the same area where all these things happen. They happen in the mind. They take place in the psyche. You know? And I can't just park all this and do a saintly Buddhist exercise and hope that all this stuff is neatly put aside and will just disappear. It does not disappear. It's there. It's the mind that wants to meditate, the mind that tries to find freedom, stillness, grand-heartedness, and the Brahma-viharas, the universal empathy, the mind that tries to find samadhi and insight, is obviously the same mind. It's the same climate in which all this other stuff is happening. And while it's theoretically true that my awareness can liberate all this, it's practically true that much of my awareness is what the Jungians would call in the shadow. It's tied up with something. And at some point, I have to look at what's there. I can't just kind of operate with the bit that I can have access to and hope the rest will disappear and vanish into thin air. And, you know, stout-heartedly turn myself away from it and believe that if I just march on heroically enough, it will have evaporated by the time I look again. It does not. We all know this is not the case. We all know that the mind is quite capricious. You know? One part says, yes, I want to lose weight. Yes, I want to renounce. Yes, I want to be less dependent on sensory happiness, less dependent on my fridge, less dependent on things that I enjoy 10 seconds on my tongue, and then I digest them for a few hours, and then I have to work out for 10 months to get them off my hips again. You know, I want to be more free of this. And another part says, no, you know, I don't want this. I want to have it now. I want it sweet. Stop giving me this Buddhist renunciation line. You old sourpuss, I'm going to eat it now. Yeah? Then you go and eat it. And then the same voice says, I wouldn't have done that if I were you. We're contradictory, we all know this. However, whatever spiritual spin you're going to put on this, there are contradictory voices, there are contradictory forces in this mind. And we, any responsible notion of meditation practice will need to meet those contradictions, will need to meet the dark side somehow. Yeah? Will need to meet a side that may not be as dark as it is occasionally portrayed as. Yeah? A side that does not want to wake up. A side that wants to have its cake and eat it. Yeah? A side that seeks doggedly a happiness it knows will not last. Yeah? We'll need to meet that side. We'll need to be part. We'll need to let that part, which this mind is inhabited by, we'll need to meet that in some realistic ways. Our practice will not just be what we believe and what we would like and what we aspire to, but also how skilled we are at meeting the bits that do not want to be part of our little awakening project. Does that make sense? So, there are obviously maps in both traditions, and I think it's worth looking at some of these maps. And in some areas these maps converge, and in some areas they do not seem to converge. The problem is compounded by the fact that there are some translation issues at work. Some terms are used. This is a different time. The Buddha lived, you know, believed that he lived in the 5th century and died around the year 400 BC, and things seem to look a little different then than they look now. So different understandings, different societal structures, a different way of reflecting human experience. And when we want to understand the Buddha or his time and the teaching he leaves behind in a variety of textual transmissions, then we need to give some attention to differences in which people used to think about themselves and in which we think about ourselves. And this is work. This is hard work. It's not easily done. It's the work that takes people in many fields. It takes psychologists who are willing to dabble in Indian traditions. It means Indologists, which need to be willing to put up with psychological frameworks. It needs people who are willing to try to make sense of each other rather than defend their positions or the validity or the absolute truth of their particular school or theoretical model. And if we look around, there's quite a few models. Yeah? It would be easy if there was one Buddhism and one psychology, but anybody who is in either field will know that there's lots of different Buddhisms and lots of different psychologies. There's a guy called Mitchell who a few years ago said he could identify at least 7 models of self in post-classical psychoanalysis. Yeah. So people using quite similar language can hold wildly contrary opinions about how such a self comes about. In fact, Buddhism seems more coherent as a field if you look at statements on the nature of how personality is built than Western psychology or the different Western psychology. And there we have some confusions to disentangle. I would like you to spend 15 minutes, turn to one of your neighbors, and basically speak with your neighbor about a very simple question. Your own observation, in your experience of meditation, which bits of your experience did not fit into the model of meditation? That's the first question. Yeah. When I'm a meditation practitioner, some of the stuff I experience is likely not to fit into my meditative model. Name some of these bits to your neighbor. I would also turn it round and say, when you meditate, and there are things happening in that meditation which you may find difficulty to have a map for in psychological terms, maybe you can name some of those bits as well. So what are you missing in the respective other fields? As a meditator, you may experience stuff that you don't have names for in psychological terms. What are these things? As a practitioner of meditation, there may be things happening in your meditation that you don't find terms in the meditative language, that are not part of your meditation instruction. So where are the question marks? In the way you think about yourself, probably informed by Western notions of psychology, and in the way you think when you're trying to be a meditative practitioner. What are the bits that are not part of your map and yet that are happening? Are you with me? No. Yeah. So, you're told to meditate, to feel your breath, to follow the sensations of breathing, and make the mind more still. That's a very simple instruction. And then there are a number of things happening. I wonder what happens when you try to do that. Does your mind immediately get still? Do you always feel your breath? I'm curious that you name some of the things that you cannot, in the language of meditative instruction, find. Yeah? And yet they keep happening. Things that happen, either in your life or in your meditation, that meditation teaching, as you know it, does not seem to account for. That is one question. The other thing is, something may happen when you, in your mind, when you meditate, or even when you're not meditating, maybe you have other moments of extraordinary experience, that you do not seem to have the language for in psychological terms. Yeah? You're with me now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think for me, the problem is that I haven't thought about that distinction before, so I'm struggling with it.
Well, that's precisely the nature of the exercise. I'd like you to. So,
but that's confusing me in terms of identifying which bits to bring up. If I think about it just in terms of.
Well, look, you will have some of you will have lots of Buddhist experience, lots of Buddhist teaching. Some of you will be absolutely new on this. Yeah. In I'm sure for all of you there will be bits which keep happening in your minds that you do not seem to be able to pigeonhole in terms of your Buddhist teaching. Yeah. I'm also pretty sure that some things happen in your minds that you will find difficult naming in psychological terms.
Yeah. So psychological terms, could you give us an example?
Is there an example?
Distraction would be a psychological term. Anger would be a psychological term. Images would be a psychological term. Yeah. Yeah. I'm interested that you talk about this with your neighbor. can you try to figure that out? Identifying bits that don't seem to fit the